Hey, what's going on, everyone? Thank you so much for joining me today on Vicious Whispers with Mark Tullius. Today is episode 26. We have the final chapter of the Brightside audiobook. That's chapter 19. If you guys haven't listened to it yet, you can get it for free on SoundCloud. The first 10 chapters are up. You go to previous episodes, or you can pick it up on Audible, Amazon, iTunes, wherever they sell audiobooks. And if you are into libraries, and if your library doesn't have it, which they should, just ask them to carry it and they could pick it up. It's super cheap for them. That would be a big help for me too. So please do that. And with my other audiobooks, all my audiobooks are up except for the two behind me. Unlocking the Cage should be out in about a week. We got to redo some of the names. And then Ain't No Messiah will probably be out in about 2 months. My buddy Jeff Campbell, who did the awesome artwork, he is also going to be narrating it, so that should be fun. I'll be involved in that recording, and so that should be awesome. But yeah, everything else is up. This weekend was the LA Times Festival of Books. I was at booth 910, and man, it was a long weekend. You have to get there, got there around 7 o'clock or so, 7:30 to set up. Festival started at 10, went until 6 on Saturday. Following day was similar, but it went till 5, and I stood the whole fucking time. Between those 2 days, I never left the booth, and I did maybe 5 to 10 minutes of sitting down. The rest of the time, I was fucking trying to pimp myself. I was being Mr. Friendly, stepping out of my comfort zone, saying hi to everybody, asking if they like scary shit, and trying to hand them one of these pamphlets with my pretty face on the back. These are probably the best thing I've ever done, especially for festivals, because it has the first couple pages of each of the books. So Ain't No Messiah, the first page of Brightside, Each Done I Die, and then also Unlock in the Cage. And I would just tell people, just check it out. They could read the first page. They'll know right away whether they like my style. And that was one of the nice things about this weekend too. I went in with much more confidence, being able to say, okay, I do have the proof. I am a good author. Here are all the reviews. I did a review sheet with the main points from all the different reviews I've gotten in each book. So each book had its own little page, had the Amazon rating, and so I was like, here's a proof to see whether or not you like my style. A lot of people, I was wedged in between two booths that were kind of religious, and then I was in the middle of that shit, so that was a little bit odd. But if people didn't like scary shit, I'd just pass them on to the next booth. And then and then they did the same. So they were good people. That was cool. Worked out well. Things I would have done differently. I would have got a booth that was fucking in the shade because it was hot and people don't want to be standing out there. I didn't want to stand out there. Luckily I brought sunscreen. So that part wasn't bad. But the one thing I really wish I had done, I should have done, and I had the shit with me, was to set up a little stand with all the books on it and a page that says read the first page, dare to read the first page. I did that at one of the festivals, had awesome response because people would be drawn to it, they would pick a book, they would start reading, next thing you know they're buying it. This time I did not do that, so I had to try to get people into the booth, which was much harder. A lot of people ran and screamed and said, stop grabbing me. I was like, no, fuck you, come read my shit. I didn't do that. But got a little distracted with my imagination. Fucking thing gets out of control sometimes. So I did not do Dare to Read the First Page. The next time I do a festival, I most definitely will. One of the things that this did do for me though was made me want to do more festivals again. So I am looking in my local areas, trying to figure out where I can do readings, where I can do little book signings, sell books. I might be going to Vegas soon to do their first Friday. That'd be pretty awesome since I have so many friends there, and this is MMA capital, so Unlocking the Cage would probably do well there. And maybe not so far, Ain't No Messiah would probably do much better too, especially since it won't be right around Easter with everyone giving me dirty ass looks. There were a lot of God-fearing people walking around on Sunday and Saturday. But it was good. Didn't get into any arguments. No one got upset at me. Well, they might have got upset at me, but no one came up and talked to me about it, about being upset. So that was cool. So looking up different festivals, definitely want to do that. One of the coolest thing was different conversations I had with people. Well, before I even get to that, let's go to the other part of it, things I wish I'd done differently. I need to stop talking to crazy motherfuckers. Or just, I don't have a problem, and maybe they weren't crazy, crazy, but you can tell when someone's not in their right mind. I knew these people were a little bit off, but I was still super cool with them, treating them like anyone else. The only problem was lots of them would want to keep talking and talking and talking, and so I need to get better at being like, hey, dude, fucking haul ass, I'm working. So I need to figure that out, how to handle that approach. But all the positive stuff, man, I had some pretty awesome conversations. I think they're conversations that will stick with these people for a while. I even got one guy who was really cool, this guy, Aaron, who agreed to do a writing assignment with me. So I thought that was going to be super cool. He should be writing to me soon. He's reading Brightside, or his wife's reading Brightside. He's reading Twisted Reunion, Ain't No Messiah. So that should be awesome. But yeah, I had lots of cool conversations. A lot of writers, a lot of people that want to write or are in the process of writing, maybe overwhelmed by it. Lots of people working on their first novels, looking for advice. And then there were tons of authors that were trying to understand how to start. And to me, I was like, well, all that information is out there. Just look that shit up. But I had some great conversations. I was able to help people out. They're pretty grateful. So that was all cool. But then on top of meeting all these new people, making some new friends, one of my buddies, hadn't seen him in 20, 21 years. I used to train with him, fought together with him, yeah, 1998. So Boss Rutten was our first coach together. And so even though I only known him for a short period of time, it was awesome. He made the long drive out with his daughter and wife, and he came by. We talked for a while, my buddy Isaac. So that was cool. It was cool. Great to see him again. And yeah, so overall, pretty awesome experience. I was fucking tired. I was beat. My body was just exhausted. But got through it and looking forward to the next one. Oh, one of the other things, I also talked with a lot of the members of the Horror Writers Association. I'm a member of it, and they have a booth, and I could have just gone into their booth and sold books there, which I did once before, and that was awesome. But I was talking to a couple other people, and they're asking me why I didn't do it. And I was like, well, I kind of don't feel like I'm a real horror writer, and I haven't been to the meetings, and blah, 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 blah. And a couple of them pointed out, they're like, well, you know what? That's total imposter syndrome. You got to stop. Look at what you've already produced. And so that kind of made me feel good because, I don't know, these are authors that I respect. And then I'm realizing, it's like, oh, yeah, I do have more published than they do, and or whatever else. So I need to take myself a little bit more seriously. I don't know if seriously is the right word, but I need to stop worrying that I'm not good enough or whatever else, what other bullshit ideas are in my head with that negative inner voice. Last week I mentioned I was going to try to do 2 days of jiu-jitsu because I'm fucking crazy. I did 3 days of yoga, which is awesome. And but then I decided, I went in Wednesday night, and it was just myself, one other guy. I've worked with him before. He's only been training maybe a year or so, but he's a big dude. He's 290 pounds. He's super flexible. But he also was an awesome partner. And my buddy Simon, who's also a purple belt, he was teaching class, so it was pretty much a private, which is exactly what I needed because Simon was going over all kinds of shit that I just never used before. I had trained it before, never implemented it in rolling, and so it was cool to go over it again and to realize that now lots of these moves I couldn't do before, I am able to do because of my flexibility, how much it's improved because of yoga. So I learned a lot that night. And then the next night, I went back for open mat. My wife wasn't able to. She's taken some time off because of her hand. So she was able to stay with the kids. I went and played, and it was awesome. I got to roll with the big guy again. I believe his name's Alfred. Fuck, I'm terrible with names. But it was cool because I was able to see, I was like, even though he's 290 pounds, 80 plus, 80 pounds heavier, I was able to just use my body and being able to sweep a guy that big and then submit him, that's a good feeling. So yeah, being able to be the smaller guy and seeing that jiu-jitsu works against bigger guys, that's always fun. And yes, he's definitely less experienced, and I'm not gonna be able to do that to him that much longer, especially when I'm showing him, hey man, when I'm trying to do this, you do that. But it was definitely felt good. Training with a couple other guys, those were all awesome roles. And one really cool thing that happened was there was a guy who showed up. I think I had rolled once, and then he comes up to me. He's like, hey man, he's like, can I roll with you? I was like, sure. He's like, I've never done jiu-jitsu before. I was like, never done it? He's like, no. I was like, you never been to a class? Nope. I was like, have you ever watched it? Do you like watching it? He's like, no, I've never really watched it. Are you a fan of MMA? No, not really. I was like, well, why do you decide to do it? He's like, well, I just want to learn how to fight, and everything I've read said, jiu-jitsu would be good for that. I said, most definitely. I think it's one of the best martial arts for fighting, whether it's MMA or on the street. And so I was like, that was cool. So I gave him a quick rundown on basic positions, trying to show him stuff. But what was cool was, I was like, this is this guy's first time being exposed to jiu-jitsu. I was like, if he had picked the wrong person, it could have been terrible. He never would have came back. But I was able to be super cool with him, introduce him to other guys, show him some basics, but more importantly, tell him some of the fundamental stuff and try to get the philosophy like, hey man, go slow, go easy, watch, learn. All the things that I did wrong, I was trying to pass on to him of not to do. And one thing was that was really cool was early on, I told him that before I used to teach, I'm not a yoga teacher, but I would implement yoga at the start of our jiu-jitsu practice. And I was thinking about starting that up again during the days. And then at the end of the night, he came up to me, he's like, man, he's like, if you do the yoga, he's like, please let me know because I want to do it. He said, I was watching you, and I was able to see that because of your flexibility, you're able to do so much more. He's like, I can see how the yoga would be effective and why it would be good. So I was like, that's cool. I sold a dude on yoga. That's always fun. So the training was fun. I believe I am going to try it again. I feel good right now. I was beat up for a day or two. Just little minor shit. Got adjusted. So I think like that would be ideal. If I could do 3 days of yoga, 2 days of jiu-jitsu, that would be pretty awesome. So that is the game plan. Whether or not it actually happens, we will see. But that's what I'm shooting for. All right, guys, I think that's about it. I got a lot of work to do. I need to send out a newsletter. I need to go to therapy because I gotta figure out what the fuck's wrong with me. And what else, what else, what else? Then I got to pick up kids, take them to jiu-jitsu, all that kinds of fun stuff. But it is good. It is fun. I enjoy watching my son train. I enjoy watching my daughter train or play volleyball or whatever it is. So, oh, another cool thing is next week, I'm not sure when I'm going to record a podcast because we will be up in Oregon. Maybe I'll take my stuff with me. We got an awesome place right on the Rogue River. So it should be really cool, which is Southern Oregon, just above California and like the Grants Pass area. So that should be really cool. We're gonna have 4 or 5 days, leave on an Easter of just hanging out, probably zip lining, horseback riding, hiking, all that kind of good stuff, rafting. So that's what I will be doing. Maybe I'll put out a podcast before that. We'll talk about Brightside, what I got from it, talk about Try Not to Die in Brightside, which is coming up next, and maybe throw in a little, maybe we'll throw in a couple horror stories until we're ready to start getting into Try Not to Die in the Bright Side and the big contest we're going to be having with that, which I still need to figure out. And I still need Donna to finish recording. So all that will come together, But for now, let's enjoy the final chapter of Brightside. Probably my favorite chapter, and changed so much from the original. We'll talk about the original, what happened in the original version next week, if I remember. Maybe I'll write it down and I will. All right, guys, hope you guys enjoy. This is chapter 19 of Brightside, narrated by T. Quillen. I will see you guys next week. Later.
Chapter 19. Most of the lampposts in the park are lit, but a couple have been shot out, glass scattered beneath them. I make it to the square. The streets are so quiet and empty, it's creepy. It must be because of the curfew, which makes me realize trying the deli is pointless. No one is going to be there, so I head for Lodge 2. I have to cross the street, but otherwise, I try to stay up against the buildings. There's a boot up ahead. He's scraping something off his sole, gum or something. I crouch as low as I can without putting my ass on the ground. It puts pressure on my ankle, but I can't be seen. The boot is hopping around on one leg, losing his balance. I slip around the corner, cross in between two buildings. I start to take a left when I hear this faint buzzing sound. There's a security camera somewhere. They must have realized most of them have been disabled. I wonder how many are back on. There's a fence to the left. It's about 5 feet high. I check both ways, then take off and run, but my ankle gives out. My hand goes to the pavement. I'm completely exposed, so I spring up and hobble onto the grass. I climb the fence, flinging my body over the top, and land on my side to protect my ankle. Lodge 2 is just over a small hill. I creep towards it, see two boots out front. They're armed and trying to look real serious, even though no one is around. I figure there must be a camera on the front door. They're being watched, which means I need to find another way in. I swoop around towards the side and look up at the second floor. There's no way I could climb it, even with two good angles. But the first floor offers opportunity. There's a window, and it's slightly open, which is odd in this cold. I move in closer and hear voices inside the apartment. A woman says,
"I told you I was sick."
A man says, "Oh, believe me, I know, and it's disgusting." I duck walk the rest of the way, praying there isn't a camera. I get to the ledge and slowly lift my head up over the sill. The living room is empty, just the same shitty furniture as every apartment in Brightside. The bedroom door is closed, and so is the bathroom. They both have lights on, which spills out under the doors. My breath is streaming fog, and I can barely feel my fingers. I look at my watch. I only have 5 minutes to make it back. I'm already behind schedule, and I haven't even made it to the second floor. Instinct tells me to turn back. I can still make it if I hurry, but Wendell keeps popping into my head, his giant body splayed on the wet bathroom floor, the holes in his chest, his face. The window gives the slightest creak as I lift it a few inches. Luckily, the couple is still arguing from different rooms. I don't think they can even hear each other, because they're saying the same thing. I press up on my right foot and hoist myself through. My stupid coat is getting stuck, so I have to wiggle a bit. I nearly propel my face to the floor, but my hands spring out and soften the blow. I'm heading for the front door when I hear a flush. The knob begins to turn, and I nearly trip over the coffee table, my hand frantically reaching out for the door. The bathroom light flicks off, and I turn the knob and slip out just in time. The hallway's empty. The stairs are at the other end. I hobble and hurry and use the handrail to keep the weight off my left foot. There are at least 8 doors on the second floor, and I have no idea which one is Becky's. I don't have time to try them all, so I knock on the first one. A middle-aged woman with dry, frizzy hair answers. I think I've seen her washing dishes at the diner. "I'm looking for Becky," I say.
"No, Becky lives here."
"Okay, but she's on this floor. Do you know which one is hers?" The woman scratches her scalp and something comes off in her nail. She pinches it and studies it. "Please, her name's Becky, Wendell's sister."
"Oh,"
she says, drawing out the word like it has 15 letters.
"Yeah, weird girl. She's over there."
The woman points to the last door on the right. There's still a piece of scab under her nail. I tell her thanks and start hobbling. This floor seems so familiar, but I can't remember ever being here. I knock on the last door. A girl says,
I'm in bed.
She sounds frightened, like she's been caught doing something bad. Becky, I'm a friend of your brother's. Please, just come to the door. I hear her moving around. I also see the middle-aged woman peering out her door, but as long as she's peering, she's not calling the boots. Finally, the door opens, and I see Becky, a frail, freckle-faced girl with big brown eyes that look like she's been crying. You don't know me, I say, but your brother sent me.
My brother's dead.
Yeah, I know, and I'm sorry, but he asked me to make sure. Can I come in? It's like she knows she's being watched. She says,
No, I can't have visitors.
I'm not trying to get you in trouble, but your brother asked me to come get you.
Why?
So you can leave Brightside for good.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I know she's lying, but she's also scared. She starts to close the door, but I block with my left foot, pain ripping through my ankle. I grit my teeth. He risked his life for me, Becky. He did it so I could escape and so you could too. Your brother wanted you to get out. He made me promise I'd come get you. Now, I can't force you to do anything, but I gave Wendell my word. I owe him. That's why I'm here. But you have to make up your mind, and it has to be right now. We don't have any more time. Becky stares at nothing, trying to process what I'm telling her. But she's also thinking about Wendell. She knows her brother would have done anything to help her escape. The door behind me opens, and I hear this awful voice I know too well.
What the fuck are you doing here?
Crystal. And it all comes back. Lodge 2. Second floor. I stay focused. So what's it gonna be, Becky?
Oh shit, Crystal laughs. You're a fucking pervert. She's 16.
Becky, you have to decide right now. Yes or no? Becky keeps staring at the floor. She's unable or unwilling to comprehend what I'm saying. I start to think this is a mistake. Here I am trying to convince a girl I've never met to run off with me into the woods. And Sharon's ride is probably already here, about to leave, and I'm going to miss it. But then Becky looks up with those big brown eyes and nods. I silently tell her to get her coat, that we're already late. She asks if she can pack a bag, and I tell her there's no time. Sharon's club is leaving as we speak. I shouldn't have thought it. Regretted it the moment it flew out of my head.
You're the ones causing this shit?
Crystal's voice fills the entire lodge.
That's why we have a curfew? So you idiots can try to escape?
Crystal is shoving me, prodding her fingers into the back of my head. Other doors start opening, people popping out to see what's going on. I try not to look at them, but I catch a young man's eyes. He wants to know if it's true, if there really is a way off this mountain. I don't mean to picture the pond, the carvings in the tree, the hill, and the cave. Or maybe I do. I have no clue what I'm doing anymore. Then another familiar sound, far worse than Crystal. The faint sound of footsteps. And they're getting louder and louder. I jump into Becky's room, slam the door, lock it. Crystal banging and screaming and telling everyone the traitor is right here. Becky puts on her coat, her boots. I hobble to the window and open it. There are some bushes, and it looks like a snowbank has blown up against the building. Crystal's outside the door, telling the boots to hurry up. I take Becky's hand, tell her it's going to be okay. She ducks her head under the window and slips out first, her fingers gripping the sill. She's terrified. It's okay. Just jump. Words I never thought would ever leave my mouth. But Becky lets go and falls. And I stick my head out to see her lying on her back. I can't tell if she's breathing. But then she smiles. The key slips into the lock. The bolt turns. I stick my leg through the window, duck under, and look back to see the doorknob turn. I let go, just falling in the dark. The snow breaks my fall, but not really. I'm heavier than Becky, and she already smashed a lot of the powder. I can barely breathe, but I pull myself up, keep most of my weight on my right foot as we run for the park. I'm running, hobbling down the path, shouting for Becky to keep up. I hear voices in the distance. Someone says we're heading for the trees. I take Becky's hand so we don't get separated. She's so light, she's not sinking in the snow like I am when we step off the path and into the woods. I practically drag her between two enormous pines, the needles scratching our faces and clothes. Someone yells, "Stop right there!" But I don't look back. Just keep moving as fast as my ankle will let me.
"Are they going to shoot us?"
Becky asks. "No," I tell her. "They have to warn us first." A cloud rises over the moon, and I can hardly see all the rocks and dead logs. I nearly trip, so does Becky. I say, "Keep going. That's all we have to do." I can see the tree with my carvings, but I can't be sure. Gunfire erupts behind us, bullets blowing through the branches on both sides. So much for a warning. Another bullet whizzes by. It's so close, my entire body is covered with goosebumps. Carvings or not, I yank us right. My ankle's practically numb from the snow, and we sprint through a bunch of trees and start moving up the hill. Becky's frail, but she's a fighter, keeps churning, running, even when it sounds like she's about to have an asthma attack. Other than her labored breaths, I don't hear anything. No more shots. I wonder if we somehow lost them. It's only 30 yards to the cave. I squeeze Becky's hand and keep pulling her up the hill until we hit the rubble. I look back, expecting to see a dozen boots storming like it's the beaches of Normandy. But no one seems to be coming. I realize Wayne's body is missing too. I know he didn't just stand up and walk away, though. I saw the bullet enter his psychotic brain. There's a 3-foot-wide path that leads to the trees. The Brightsiders must have dragged him away to keep the boots off our trail. I lift Becky over the remaining rocks blocking the cave, set her down in the darkness.
"What is this?"
Becky asks. I silently tell her to be quiet. I'm not holding her hand, but I know she's trembling. I reach into my pocket for my keys, but my fingers are so frozen I can't keep a grip. They cling around on the ground. I kneel, put my hands on the cold dirt, and sweep them around until I hear a jingle. I pick up the keys and hold them out in front of my face. I can't see anything but black.
"I want to go home,"
Becky says. "Hold on." Danny's little flashlight clicks and shines across the ground. I see the rusty steel tracks. "We just have to follow these. Come on." Becky wraps her hands around my arm, and we start moving. The wooden beams creak as we descend down the belly of the mountain. The tunnel splits after a few hundred yards. I take us right. I silently tell Becky what part of the mountain we're walking under, even though I'm not entirely sure. I just know she loosens her grip a little. She asks if this could collapse. Out loud, she asks,
"How could anyone find us if it does?"
I cover her mouth. There's someone coming. They're ways behind us, but not that far. I silently tell Becky we have to run. I'm pretty sure she's nodding, even though I can't see her face. I quicken our pace, remind her to tread lightly, to keep quiet, even though I can't. The numbness in my ankle has worn off, and the pain is searing. I keep dragging my left foot no matter how much I try not to. It's scraping across the rocks and dirt and echoing so loud. Becky takes the flashlight, which lets me balance better. I put one hand on her shoulder.
"How much farther?"
she asks. I honestly don't remember. It's been 2 weeks since I've stepped foot in the mineshaft, but I don't think we have far to go. But the boots are getting closer. I can't tell how many of them there are, but it really doesn't matter since I don't have the shotgun. Suddenly more voices. Familiar ones, but not from behind. They're just up ahead. I can see the end of the rope ladder anchored into the steel plates just under the tracks. Each rung gets a bit brighter. The exit to the mine is 10 yards away. And we have company. Danny and Sarah are standing at the edge, 100 stars twinkling behind them. It's the most beautiful sight I've ever seen. But I'm still mad. What are you doing here? I ask.
Joe!
I slam my hand over Danny's mouth and turn back into the darkness. I can't tell if the boots are moving quicker or not. I turn to Sarah. I told you to go.
Danny refused. Yeah, I refused.
I step up to the ledge and look down 200 feet. The last of Sharon's club is loading into the back of a huge moving truck. Sharon walks up to the driver. I can't see his face, but he's clearly pissing her off. Her arms swing wildly as she screams, but the guy's not budging, and Sharon looks up at us. I can barely hear her saying,
"Fucking move!"
Come on, we have to go, Danny. Can you do this? Danny nods and gets down on his knees. He grips the rungs. Little by little, he crawls backwards, down over the ledge. Sarah is telling him to be careful. He's almost vertical when he just stops. Sarah's eyes pop.
What's wrong?
She asks. Danny must think he's outside now, hanging off the ledge, that he can talk as loud as he wants.
I found your gun, Joe.
Danny, be quiet. Danny's face turns red. I silently ask him where it is, and Danny's head jerks toward my left. I fear he's going to fling himself right off the ladder. There it is, up against the rock wall of the tunnel. American metal. Dad's gift. I walk over and pick it up. The boots are getting closer. We all hear it.
Danny, you have to hurry,
Sarah thinks.
But be careful.
Danny keeps climbing down, and I tell Becky to go next. I don't know why I think she's going to have a problem with this after she's jumped out her window. But it's a short fear. She drops to her knees and descends like she's been living in a circus. She even has to slow down to keep from stepping on Danny's head. Sarah and I lean over and watch them like two proud, nervous parents. But reality comes screeching back when I see the flashlights. Sarah, you need to go. Now. Sarah struggles more than Danny or Becky. But soon she's over the edge. I've got the shotgun aimed down the tunnel. I give a quick look back over my shoulder and see Sarah staring up.
Joe, come on.
I'll catch up. Don't worry. Keep going. My fingers tight against the trigger, and it feels good. It's not just the gun anymore. It's our savior and protector. And it's going to make sure Sarah, Danny, and Becky make it to the truck. I hardly know Becky, but I'm glad she made it. I only wish I could have brought more. It feels wrong to leave so many behind, but there's nothing I can do. I slide over to the rock wall and lean against it, try to stay out of the moonlight. I don't want the boots to see me and duck back, turning this into some prolonged gunfight. I'm too tired and sore, and I don't have enough ammo. 200 feet down, that's all that stands between me and home, wherever that might be. The boots are arguing with each other. They're telling one to shut up. They must see the ladder, because they've stopped moving. The flashlight clicks off. I was hoping they'd keep it on to let me know where to shoot, but it probably would have blinded me. One eye closed, shoulders relaxed, barrel up. The boots are trying to tread lightly, just like I told Becky, but those hard heels can't be silenced. I clear out my thoughts, focus on the sounds. There's at least 3, maybe 4. I assume there'd be a lot more. But I bet half of them took the path where the tunnels split. I just wish I could tell if they were walking single file or side by side. My hand slips into my pocket. I've got 4 more shells. The only problem is, there isn't any cover, so the first round can't miss. I inhale slowly, exhale slowly. Inhale and hold. The first boot comes out. He's not even looking at me, just marveling at the stars. I wait an extra second to see if another one is going to follow. Sure enough, one boot does. They're standing so close, I'll hit them both even if I only aim at one. I crack the shot off and the kickback slams me into the wall. It fucking kills. I should have given myself space, but at least both boots are on the ground. One's dead, and the other's well on his way. I click open the barrel and load two more shells when a bullet rips into the rock by my head. Little jagged shards cut into my neck. My eyes are closed when I start to take aim at the third boot, but they're wide open by the time I get the gun parallel to the ground. The next shot tears right through his neck. Looks like his whole head might come clean off, but it stays intact as he falls onto his dead partners. I load another round and try to be as quiet as possible. I don't hear any more boot steps. I don't hear breathing or even someone cocking the hammer. It's just silent. I take a quick look back over the edge, see everyone waiting inside the truck. I know they aren't going to wait much longer, so I get down on my knees and crawl toward the ladder. I keep the shotgun aimed for another 20 seconds or so, just in case that last boot has more patience than the others. But there's not a sound. I need to go. I slide the shotgun down my back inside my coat and use one hand to shove it in the back of my pants and into the crack of my ass. The rungs are cold on my fingers. I start to back up. The rungs are getting slippery, but I know it's just my sweat. My heart is thumping in my chest. I realize that in the last hour I've stood on a high rooftop and jumped out a window, but there is just something about facing the fall backwards that throws my guts up towards my chest. I keep telling myself, just don't look down. My ankle throbs, but I keep moving. I'm almost halfway down when the rock next to my face explodes, spraying bits into my eyes and mouth. Another bullet, but not from above. It came from somewhere off to the left, in the distance. My cheeks and eyelids feel like I just dove into a pool of needles. I grip the rung with my right hand, while my left wipes away the little shards in the corner of my eye. I hear Sarah and Danny screaming from below, but I still can't look down. I turn left and see this 20-something ranger posted up on the hill, the muzzle of his rifle aimed at me. Palmer, the dickhead boot, gets out of his car, stands right beside him, hands behind his back like he's watching a tennis match. Melvin fires his revolver, which has no chance of doing anything except add to the noise because he's too far away. Danny screams for me to hurry, and I'm trying, but my ankle keeps giving out, and I can only come down with my right foot. I'm halfway down, 100 feet from the ground. The next crack of the rifle is almost as loud as the crunching sound the bullet makes as it blasts through my clavicle. My left hand just flies off the rung, so now I'm holding on with my right. I finally look down. Fuck me. I force myself to look up, which isn't any better. The ranger takes aim, the barrel of that rifle pointed right at my skull. If I don't move, I won't even hear the crack. My brains and blood will just rain down on Sharon's chosen few. I try to swing my left arm up to a rung to give me some stability, but all I feel is red-hot searing pain through my shoulder. I can't even squeeze a fist. Palmer smiles and cocks his finger at me. The ranger fires off a shot, and I curl my body back under the ladder. The bullet zips by my neck as I slam into the rock. The ladder is all twisted now, and I try to flip it back before the ranger reloads, but my right hand slips. I don't know how many rungs I try to grab on the way down before I finally get one, my legs wrapping around the ladder. Everything's tangled, and the shotgun falls and cracks against the rocks below. I force myself to look. Need to know exactly how far I have to fall. It's at least another 50 feet. I have to drop if he fires again, even if I shatter my legs. I look out and I see the ranger and Palmer enjoying themselves. But I'm enjoying something too. Melvin has moved into position. They don't see him. The ranger reloads. Palmer gives him the signal. I see my left leg is over the rung, meaning if I let go, I'm just going to flip upside down. I try to pull out my leg, but it's impossible with only one hand. My left is just hanging at my side. Another shot fired, then another. I squeeze my eyes, wait for death, but it never comes. I finally peek and see Palmer and his ranger both slumped over, both dead. Sheriff Melvin is making his way back towards the truck. My right hand is starting to lose its grip, but my left leg is still over the rung. I pull up with everything I've got and jerk my leg up and free myself. I take a second to catch my breath. It's just 50 feet. I can do this. It's slow and painful, but I'm coming down, rung by rung. Only 20 feet to go. I take a small break. Look out at Danny and Sarah, expecting to see smiles or them running towards me, but everyone is just staring up. It's not good. 6 boots, all poised at the edge of the mineshaft, each one armed and pointing at a different target. Sheriff Melvin is running, but he's still too far away. I start to laugh. Why I thought the worst was over, I haven't a clue.
"Fucking do it!" I yell. "Just fucking shoot me!"
Then comes a slow rumble. A stampede of 100 feet mixed with wild howls. It just keeps getting louder and louder until the entire night is filled with its primal roar. The boots come flying off the ledge. Arms and legs flail against the laws of nature. They pass me one by one, each smacking like slabs of meat on the rocks below. I look out at Danny and Sarah. I've never seen them so happy. Then the ladder starts to shake, and I look up. I see a pair of feet coming down. I lean out, and I see more following. Brightsiders climbing down from the hell above. I have no choice but to get moving. I drop 2 rungs at a time, knowing if I don't, I'm going to get kicked off, because they're all coming. I drop the last few feet and rip more tendons in my ankle, but Danny and Sarah are there to help me to the truck. Sharon's yelling at the driver to go, but he gets out and runs over to us. I finally see his face, but I can't decide whether to hug him or punch him. He smiles and thinks, "We'll have time for both, Joe." Dad tells Danny to grab my legs. "Come on, we have to get him in." They fling me into the back of the truck, crammed in with the others. Brightsiders run for the truck, but the roll-up door clangs down. They bang on the back and beg to be let in, but their cries fade as we pull away. Their chances aren't good on foot, but they have 10 hours of darkness. If they split up and hide, some should slip away. Sarah eases me into her arms, careful of my shoulder. She kisses my head and tells me not to close my eyes, that I have to stay awake. I think about the ones we left behind, lost and wandering in this desert valley. Most are probably cursing us. But as I look around, I know we couldn't have fit more than 1 or 2. The others would have flipped the truck, torn us to shreds. I pray that they see the sunrise, that they live long enough to tell the tale to their grandkids. I pray the Brightsiders that stayed behind aren't punished for our sins. I hear my prayer echoing in the minds of everyone around me. We're the lucky ones. Sharon's special club. But I realize it's my club, too, as Becky slides her foot against mine, and Sarah pulls me into her arms. Sarah whispers, "You did good." I nod and try to tell myself she's right. But I can't stop thinking about Rachel and Wendell and Crystal and "shh," Sarah says. She's pointing at Danny, sitting by the door. Eyes closed, humming along to the sound of the tires. He's not thinking about anything, just humming. His mind as tranquil as the farthest reaches of space. I don't even realize I'm laughing, but I can't stop. My head flops back, and Sarah has to move out of the way. The others stare at me like I've lost my mind. Maybe I have, I don't know. But I'm not alone. Sarah's chest is shaking into my back. She's trying to control it, but I hear her giggle. It spreads around the truck. Becky starts to ask what's so funny, but it takes her too. She covers her face and throws her head into Danny's arm. He snorts, and what started out as a little stream is now a raging river. All of us doubled over, wiping our tears, cackling like maniacs. And no one has any idea why. All we know is that right now, there's not one single thought in this truck. For once, we're actually free.